as a commons, reclaiming our knowledge of the seed as a commons, reclaiming our duty to the seed as a commons, and reclaiming our rights to the seed as a commons. We have to do everything to protect the future of life on Earth, to protect our present, and to protect our freedom. There has never been a threat to freedom as deep as what we face today through the control over the seed.
Today on Tell Somebody, ecological activist and author Dr. Vandana Shiva talks about her work and her upcoming visit to Kansas City. You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. Stand by for Tell Somebody. Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us, on Twitter at Tell Somebody Now. This is your host, Tom Clymer. If you have any comments or questions on the show, drop me a line at mail@tellsomebody.us. The views and opinions expressed on this show are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily reflect those of the station or anybody else involved with it. You'll hear Dr. Vandana Shiva in just a couple of minutes, but I need to toss out a couple of things first. Former CIA analyst Ray McGovern will be wrapping up his tour of the region this coming Monday evening at 6:30 p.m., with a talk at the Plaza branch of the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. And you can RSVP on the events page at www.kclibrary.org. The podcast of last week's show with McGovern has been posted. You can find links to stream or download the audio file at tellsomebody.us. the Tell Somebody page on the KKFI website, or subscribe to the podcast for free at the iTunes Store. Richard Tripp, director and founder of Care of Poor People, Inc., is laid up for a week or two and could really use your help pulling off this year's Spring Break for the Homeless, an event with a free meal, free clothes, and free entertainment for homeless and other folks dealing with hard times right now. This year's event is Saturday, April 19th. More information at www.coppinc.com. Friends of Community Media will join with KC Move to Amend and the All Souls Forum to present Free Press co-founder Professor Robert McChesney talking about Dollarocracy and a Digital Disconnect Sunday morning, April 6th at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church, 4501 Walnut in Kansas City, Missouri. More information at www.ourfcm.org, and keep an ear to this station for coming announcements. David Cobb, co-founder and spokesperson for Move to Amend, will be speaking at UMKC Tuesday evening, April 22nd. Look for KC Move to Amend on Facebook. And the Heartland Labor Forum is celebrating its 25th birthday. do tune in tonight at 6 p.m. right here on KKFI. On with the show. Since the first time I spoke with her on the phone for a segment about water privatization on the Heartland Labor Forum in 2003, I have been hoping Dr. Vandana Shiva would someday make it to Kansas City. So I was delighted to read a couple of months ago that Cultivate Kansas City was partnering with UMKC to host a two-day visit by Vandana Shiva on Thursday, April 17th and Friday, April 18th. There's more information on that at www.cultivatekc.org. Vandana Shiva is a world-renowned physicist, feminist, activist, and author. Her many books include Water Wars, Soil Not Oil, and Making Peace with the Earth. I called her in Delhi, India, and recorded this conversation. Give a listen. Vandana Shiva, welcome back to Tell Somebody.
Good to be back.
And we're very much looking forward to seeing you and hearing you in Kansas City on April 17th.
Not that long ahead, yes, soon.
Coming up fast. I've long hoped to see that you would visit Kansas City, and here it comes. You were, as I understand it, trained and educated as a nuclear physicist and worked on quantum theory. How did you get into seed saving and ecological activism? That would strike some people as not being connected.
Well, I did physics for the same reasons. I'm saving seeds, a passion for nature, a passion to understand nature. And in the days when I did my MSc honors in physics, nuclear physics was the top thing to do. And I did train in our nuclear establishment. But I moved away from nuclear physics when my sister, who's a medical doctor, started to have discussions with me about issues of radiation. And I realized I knew nothing about the biological side of radiation, and I felt I needed to understand the whole, so I joined theoretical physics. I started a PhD in India in particle physics, but the questions that were being constantly raised were about the foundations of quantum theory, and so I followed everyone who was working on the foundations, and they were being gathered in a colloquium on quantum theory for 5 years. Everyone from around the world, every physicist, every mathematician, every philosopher at the University of Western Ontario. So that's why I ended up doing my PhD. Now, how does that connect to what I do on seed? Of course, in terms of a career, it's very different. I had to give up university. I had to leave institutions and really become a servant of the earth and a servant of people's movement. But what connects it is this. Quantum theory teaches you that there are nothing like fixed things in the world. That was the old Newtonian, Cartesian understanding. The world is made of potential. And the same is the case with seed. I mean, a little seed holds in it the potential of becoming a giant tree. More than that, it holds in it the potential of millennia of unfolding. And it's the same in quantum theory. The second thing quantum theory teaches you, and this was my topic for my doctoral thesis, non-locality and non-separability in quantum theory. That in quantum theory, things don't separate. Because everything's connected through this potential field, the field of potential, the seed is not separate from its history. The seed is not separate from the soil into which it's planted. It's not separate from the communities with such love and care have evolved it over thousands of years. So both in the seed and in the quanta, potential to unfold and evolve and non-separability. And I think those are universal principles of the way this beautiful world of ours functions.
And you speak about the potential of seeds, and it has always been stunning to me that something like a seed that people have collected and planted for thousands and thousands of years should be subject to patents. And we're here in Kansas City in the same state on the other side from Monsanto, headquartered in St. Louis. Can you talk about this idea of patenting seeds and your work in relation to this?
Well, my focus on seed really began in 1987 when I was invited to a meeting on the new biotechnologies. It had a combination of people from the United Nations, people from industry, independent scientists, and I just finished my book on the violence of the Green Revolution to understand why Punjab was had become a zone of such violence when the Green Revolution had been given a Nobel Peace Prize. And in fact, I've just been told they're going to put up a statue of Norman Borlaug in Washington for the amazing things he did for the world. But he left a legacy of bloodshed. He left a legacy of destroyed water and a cancer train that leaves Punjab. But in the 80s, in 84, Punjab had really become a land of violence. 30,000 people were killed, and I just couldn't put this together with the Nobel Peace Prize. So I said, I've got to study this. I wrote a book, and that got me invited to this meeting. And the industry, you know, at that point had no commercial GMO. In fact, Monsanto was not even a big player at that time. It was still a chemical company related to Agent Orange. The Seabers and the Sandozes were the players. And they said that, A, they said they were too small, these giants. The second thing they said was, we'll be five companies controlling the world's food supply and health, because the same companies are the pharmaceutical industry. And they went on to say, the ones who will survive as those big five will be the ones who have the largest number of patents in their hand. And the only way to get a patent on seed is through genetic engineering, because you can pretend by putting a new gene into a plant that you've created the plant. And you're the inventor of something living which you cannot invent. Life is not an invention. They also talked about how they needed a global law to protect their patents. And my antennas went up. I just felt this would be a total dictatorship, not just over society, but over life. And I returned to India. The meetings were in Geneva and France, and I returned to India and started to save seeds, just knowing that there was a major threat. Later it came to be that Monsanto actually had written the laws in the WTO called the intellectual property laws. It's called the Trade-Related Intellectual Property Rights Agreement. And a Monsanto representative in 1995 said, in writing this agreement, we've been the patient, diagnostician, and physician all in one. We defined a problem, and for them the problem was that farmers save seeds. And the solution they created was to define seed as their intellectual property, which is a property in the product of the mine, and therefore any farmer saving seed, at that point, seed that had been patented as engaging in theft, in intellectual property theft. And I found this so wrong that not only did I dedicate myself to saving seeds and reclaiming seed in the commons through community seed banks, I also committed myself to follow Gandhi in saying no to this absurdity of corporations like Monsanto claiming to be the inventors and creators of life. And we have practiced seed satyagraha, which is the force of truth, like Gandhi practiced the salt satyagraha against the British laws that were going to make salt making a British monopoly and were designed to prevent Indians from making salt. Now, the interesting thing is that because around the world there have been such huge movements against GMOs, most people don't realize that the only reason GMOs have been pushed is to collect royalties. And in the final analysis, the royalties come from the farmers. In other businesses, royalties come from competitors. If a company that makes a telephone has a patent, then another company that wants to make a telephone has to pay a royalty for the license. and the farmers were the original custodians and givers of all the seeds that are being now patented, with the only addition of a genetically engineered BT gene or a herbicide tolerant gene. Having seen rejection of GMOs around the world, only 7 countries plant GMOs on any significant scale. The new strategy of these companies is get laws passed to ban local seeds, farmers' varieties, heritage varieties, heirloom varieties, and those are the issues we are having to deal with again, where we are saying it is our duty to save and protect diversity on Earth. And any law that makes this a crime is a criminal law in and of itself. It should not be obeyed.
Indeed. And am I correct in remembering that there have been some cases of farmers who had non-Monsanto or non-other agribusiness crops that were contaminated by pollen drifting in there from patented plants and having it held up in court that they had to pay royalties even though they didn't plant Monsanto seeds and didn't want to?
The absurdity of claiming patents on GMO seeds and now also non-GM seeds is that it's in the nature of life to reproduce, and it's in the nature of biological reproduction of plants that it's done through pollination. Now, both of these natural traits of seed are being turned on their head by Monsanto laws for patenting. There's a very significant case of the Canadian farmer Percy Smyser, whose fields of canola were contaminated by Monsanto's Roundup Ready canola. And instead of compensating Percy for contaminating his crop, Monsanto sued him for stealing their genes.
Wow.
And tried to fine him $200,000. Percy was tough, as was his wife, Louise. They fought this all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada. And the fine was struck down. But the fact that once you allow patenting of genes, then the occurrence of those genes anywhere becomes defined as intellectual property theft. In the United States, thousands of farmers have been sued by Monsanto for exactly that kind of issue. There's also a very famous case of a farmer called Bowman, B-O-W-M-A-N, and a case called Monsanto versus Bowman, where Bowman bought grain from an elevator. He did not buy Monsanto seeds. He bought grain from an elevator and planted it. And Monsanto managed to get the Supreme Court of the United States to rule that no matter how many generations down the grain is produced, it's still Monsanto's property. So you can contaminate others' fields and own their farm produce as your property. You can force farmers who are not buying from you but are buying ordinary grain in the marketplace and then planting it as stealing your property. And worse, you can come to countries like India and sell cotton seed, which used to cost 5 to 10 rupees a kilogram, sell it at 4,000 rupees a kilogram. Earlier seed used to be renewable, this is non-renewable. The cost jumps 8,000%, doesn't do the work it was designed to do, which is control pests. There are more pests now than before the GMO seed were planted. Farmers are spending 13 times more on pesticides in the region of Vidarbha. And the figure, official figure of the government of India, of suicides of farmers, beginning with 1995 when these monopolies started to get established and the WTO came into force, is 284,000 farmers. Now, these seeds are totally unreliable because they are sold on a very large scale. They're not designed as farmers design their seed for that particular patch of soil, that particular season with heavy rain or too much drought. And, of course, with climate change, we'll have more intense drought, we'll have more intense rain. But the vulnerability of these seeds makes the failure even more frequent. So from every side, farmers are being trapped into debt, and indebted farmers are committing suicide. And add to it the fact that Monsanto doesn't create these seeds, it takes our seeds. It has taken a patent on screening of all the soya seeds of the world, the traditional soya seeds in Asia, and owning them through a patent. Its limits of piracy and theft are unimaginable. And that is why we have to stop this madness of patenting of seeds and patenting of life. It was an error. It was an error made under corporate influence. There was, in the trade-related intellectual property rights agreement, a requirement that in 1999, 4 years after WTO came into force, there would be a mandatory review. My country, India, all of Africa, all of Central America has said two things. A, patents on life must be reviewed. Two, biopiracy must be stopped. And that review has been blocked by the United States government. Therefore, we need this movement against patents on seed to become strong in the United States.
Yes. This just boggles the mind that they are doing some of these things. This is Tom Clammer. You're listening to Tell Somebody, and we're talking to Dr. Vandana Shiva, who will be in Kansas City April 17th and 18th. On the 17th, she'll be speaking at Unity Temple on the Plaza, lecture billed as Cultivating Diversity, Freedom, and Hope. We'll give you more information on that after the interview. Dr. Shiva, the word Navdanya, can you tell us what that means and talk about your work in relation to that?
Well, Navdanya means both nine seeds, which is the highest you can go in diversity, because after nine you become 1-0 for 10. So nine is the highest digit. And Navdanya, I was taught by a tribal farmer, signifies the connection between the field, our bodies, and the universe. But Navdanya can also mean the new gift. Nav can mean nine, it can mean new. Dan can mean the gift. Dan can also mean the seed and the grain. So Navdanya is both the diversity of seed in balance and harmony, and it is the new gift of the commons, of reclaiming the seed as a commons, reclaiming our knowledge of the seed as a commons, reclaiming our duty to the seed as a commons, and reclaiming our rights to the seed as a commons.
And you have an organization under that name? Have I got that right?
Yes, so when I started to save seeds, I just started to save seeds. I mean, I would say seed-saving movement. I couldn't call it genetic resources because that was the word in those days of 87. We didn't have the word biodiversity. You know, biodiversity was created along with the Convention on Biological Diversity as a commonly used phrase. And genes basically means the atoms of the plant, and you can't translate it into any Indian language in any reasonable way. So it was when I was doing seed collections a few years after 87, and I was in this remote tribal village, and a farmer was growing nine seeds. And when I counted the crops, he gave me this amazing lesson. I've been saving seeds since 1987. We've helped create 120 community seed banks across India. We've now made the movement global because the attack on seed is global, and the Global Citizens Campaign for Seed Freedom is encouraging people around the world to create community seed banks, seed libraries, whatever you want to call it. At the end of the day, it's all about committing yourself to saving and sharing seed. The citizens movement has produced an amazing alliance. There's a website your listeners can visit for the seed movement globally. It is seedfreedom.in. And for Navdanya, the movement we started in India, it is navdanya.org. Of course, the seed has taught me so much, and it's made me travel a long journey. I couldn't just save seeds as a museum piece, so I started to work with farmers to do organic farming in order to use native seeds, because the new seeds are bred for chemicals. after doing organic farming for a few years, the farmer said, we've got these wonderful crops, now you've got to help us bring them to the market. And so we ended up developing fair trade. More and more people started to come for training, and so we started an Earth University and the School of the Seed at the Earth University. So the seed evolves and multiplies in the same way the journey with the seed has evolved and multiplied. And to me, it's been a very fulfilling journey, very fulfilling journey.
And I've heard you speak about 1984 as being a significant year, an important year in terms of corporate chemicals and other related things that you've been involved with. Can you talk about that just a little bit?
Well, you know, in that period when all this was happening, I was studying physics. I was sort of single-mindedly dedicated to physics. I'd got a National Science Talent Scholarship, was being sent to the top labs. And I had no idea what had happened with our agriculture till 1984. Of course, I used to go and help my mother on her farm, but that was more for fun, and it was more for play. 1984, we had two major disasters. The first was the disaster of a leak from a pesticide plant owned then by Union Carbide and now by Dow Chemicals, which is bringing to the U.S. the Agent Orange-resistant GMOs. 3,000 people died immediately. 30,000 have died since then, and hundreds of thousands are crippled for life, including unborn children. Little children who can't walk. Little children who've had severe brain damage. The second disaster was what I called the Punjab violence. Because what is called the Green Revolution, which is basically the introduction of chemical farming to agriculture, was introduced in Punjab, and in the initial stages it was introduced with subsidies. It was all right. You know, it was introduced with conditionalities. The U.S. put conditionalities on India, and the Indian government put conditionalities on farmers. But after the subsidies started to get withdrawn, farmers weren't making enough. They started to get angry and discontented. And they said they were basically slaves. They said they were being treated like slaves, where they couldn't decide how to grow a crop, what to grow, what price it would sell at. And a whole movement started in Punjab of farmers. Around May, there were very, very strong protests of farmers, including a threat to blockade grain supply to Delhi. On 4th of June, the sacred shrine of the Sikhs, the Golden Temple, had the army sent into it because one of the extremists of Punjab was in the Golden Temple. After that, of course, the violence escalated. Indira Gandhi, our Prime Minister of that time, who had ordered the military operation in Punjab, was assassinated. The Sikhs were then killed in a terrible carnage for which justice hasn't been done yet. So 84 was really a year of major tragedies. And by the end of the year, I was sitting up and saying, all this is related to agriculture. The pesticide plant of Carbide is for agriculture. What happened in Punjab, which is shown as the jewel in the crown of the Green Revolution, has been destroyed. What is the real story? So I studied it. I was those days consulting for the United Nations University on a major program on conflicts over natural resources. And I studied the Green Revolution very thoroughly, made many trips many times. I had to cancel my field trip because bombs would be blowing up trains and bombs would be blowing up buses. But I eventually completed the study and realized in the process three major things that became the basis of my commitment to look at agriculture, not just as a one-shot study, but in the long run. The first thing I learned was the chemicals in agriculture, which are called necessary for farming. Fertilizers, chemical fertilizers are necessary for farming. Without pesticides, you can't control pests. I realized all of this came from the war. Chemical fertilizers came from the same factories that made explosives. The early pesticides were designed to kill people in concentration camps and later during the wars. This was war chemicals being deployed into agriculture with a big lie of industrial farming. The second thing that went hand in hand with this was ecological agriculture is a cooperative agriculture where different species can grow together. But in the case of industrial chemical agriculture, you have to have monocultures. And we've been told that this produces more food. I have now spent 30 years of both practicing agriculture and doing deep research. And our study showed that the more the diversity, the more the output, the more the nutrition, the more the diversity, the more food we have. And the United Nations has now recognized that it's not the large-scale industrial farms clothed in toxics that are feeding the world. What's feeding the world is the caring hands of small farmers, and I would add to it gardeners in cities like Kansas City.
Dr. Vandana Shiva coming to Kansas City April 17th and 18th. At 7 to 8 p.m. Thursday the 17th, she'll be speaking at Unity Temple on the Plaza. Look on Facebook for the event page, Dr. Vandana Shiva, Cultivating Diversity, Freedom, and Hope. We'll be back with more from Dr. Shiva right after you listen to this.
What if we had more hard-hitting journalism, more local stories, more quality kids' shows, more independent voices?
What if we had more people telling their friends about the vital information they hear on KKFI? What if we had more listeners supporting community radio in Kansas City and the surrounding area? Most of the nearly 2 million people our 100,000-watt transmitter can reach have never heard of us. What if more people helped us get more hard-hitting journalism and more local stories on the air on KKFI? What if more people realized the potential of KKFI and got involved in trying to reach that potential?
What if we had less celebrity fluff, less mind-numbing advertising, less partisan shouting, less junk TV? We need more public media, better public media, new public media, now.
Welcome back to Tell Somebody. This is Tom Clammer, and before the break, we were listening to Dr. Vandana Shiva talking about the year 1984 and a growing awareness of the connection of industrialized agriculture to the chemicals of war. Let's get back to the conversation right now. We could probably do a whole show or more debunking the benefits of the so-called Green Revolution. But in a few minutes we've got left, I don't have the direct quote in front of me, so maybe you can tell me if I get the sense of it right or wrong. But I think I heard you say something to the effect of describing the work of the Monsantos and other giant corporations. Look at what they've done even before they controlled all the media and the research universities and their own industry. And you are coming to Kansas City to speak about cultivating diversity, freedom, and hope. As they've gotten more and more control over government and universities, where do you find hope?
Well, I, of course, find very deep hope in that little seed, because you plant a tiny mustard seed and it gives you 5,000 seeds. Look at the abundance and the generosity. And it's not asking for royalties. It's saying just share this abundance. The second hope I get is from those who, in this period of dictatorship over our seed and our food system, are cultivating diversity, cultivating hope, and cultivating freedom. Every step, by the tiniest of actions, that says we will not allow our agriculture to be destroyed, we will not allow our seeds to be pushed to extinction, we will not allow ourselves to be enslaved. That's where I get the hope. And that is growing so much. You know, here are five companies having to use the worst of dictatorial tools. I mean, if you have a good technology, leave it for people to choose it. They will choose it. But because you know you have something of a lie, you know all you have is toxics. And I have started to call BT crops and herbicide tolerant crops pesticide and poison producing plants, because that's what they are. If all you can bring is toxics under authoritarian control and bundled in lies, then we have to do everything to protect the future of life on Earth, to protect our present, and to protect our freedom. There has never been a threat to freedom as deep as what we face today through the control over the seed.
I have heard of Monsanto and Cargill having a lot to do with how the United States State Department has handled what's happening in Ukraine. I mean, these things are all connected somehow, aren't they?
They're all connected. And for me, the sad thing is, the United States, as a powerful democracy of the world, should be strengthening the people's movements for democracy worldwide. And in the area of seed, it means seed freedom, people's right to save seeds, have their own seeds, and be GMO-free and patent-free. The area of food, it means being able to have GMO-free food. The fact that the government of the United States has reduced itself and has reduced foreign policy to basically bulldozing countries to push Monsanto seed and to push Cargill's takeover of agriculture and food distribution. If you go back to the World Trade Organization, go back to that period when these treaties were being written, as I mentioned, Monsanto says we wrote the TRIPS agreement. Cargill's vice president was deputed to become the representative for agriculture. I do think, for the sake of the United States and the sake of the rest of the world, to avoid more conflict and more wars, it is time for the United States government to start representing the will of the people, the freedom of biodiversity, and not singularly the power of two very corrupt and very greedy corporations.
Dr. Vandana Shiva, any other final thoughts for our listeners here in Kansas City on what you hope?
I look forward to being with Grow Kansas City. I look forward to being with the people who care, and I look forward to building a very, very strong movement, because I believe deeply that coercive dictatorships can be very powerful for a very short time, but they can never last. It's a non-sustainable system of governance. And just as we saw Hitler go, we saw other dictatorships go, this will pass. We just have to have the patience and the hope.
Dr. Vandana Shiva, I want to thank you very much for spending some time with us today on Tell Somebody.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Once again, Cultivate Kansas City is partnering with UMKC to host a two-day visit by Dr. Vandana Shiva on Thursday, April 17th and Friday, April 18th, 2014. There is more information on all of this at www.cultivatekc.org or look for the Facebook event page headlined Dr. Vandana Shiva, Cultivating Diversity, Freedom, and Hope.
The sad thing is, the United States as a powerful democracy of the world should be strengthening the people's movements for democracy worldwide.
Yes, everything is connected. In a March 16, 2014 post at consortiumnews.com, J.P. Sottle, and I hope I'm pronouncing that name right, but he wrote, "Behind the U.S.-backed coup that ousted the democratically elected president of Ukraine are the economic interests of giant corporations, from Cargill to Chevron, which see the country as a potential gold mine of profits from agricultural and energy exploitation." The piece is titled, "Corporate Interests Behind Ukraine Putsch." Later in the piece, he writes, "On December 13th, Cargill announced the purchase of a stake in a Black Sea port. Cargill's port at Novorossiysk, to the east of Russia's strategically significant and historically important Crimean naval base, gives them a major entry point to Russian markets and adds them to the list of big ag companies investing in ports around the Black Sea." Close quote. Crimea. Why does that area name sound so familiar recently? And why are so many corporations around when U.S.-backed coups are going on? On Cargill's own website, they brag about being active in Ukraine for over 20 years and list acquisitions they've made of animal feed producers, grain elevators, seeds, fertilizers, and so on. And put the words Ukraine, sales jobs, and Monsanto into your Google NSA search engine and see how many and what kind of hits you get. A March 27, 2014 CBS News piece starts out saying the International Monetary Fund on Thursday pledged $18 billion in loans to prop up Ukraine's sinking economy as the nation's prime minister forecast more pain ahead without reforms that will affect nearly everyone in the country. Ah, there's that beloved one percenters austerity idea again. Tighten the belt of everyone but the rich. Last night on the fawning corporate media's PBS NewsHour, Judy Woodruff fawned over the IMF's managing director with a softball question about whether IMF conditions for their loans were too tough, asking Ukrainians to tighten their belts too much. But this was all in the context of the IMF as a tough but compassionate parent of foolish children around the world who think they are entitled to a commons in their own country, and all without the voice of a dissenter to this nonsense. But looking again at consortiumnews.com, Robert Perry writes, "It's a safe bet that most of the Ukrainians who flooded Maidan Square in Kiev in February did not do so because they wanted the International Monetary Fund to make their lives even more miserable by slashing subsidies for heat, gutting pensions, and devaluing the currency to make everyday goods more expensive. But thanks to the U.S.-backed coup that ousted elected President Viktor Yanukovych and replaced him with a regime including far-right parties, super-rich oligarchs, and technocrats with little sympathy for the suffering of average people, that's exactly what happened. Although lacking legitimacy that would come from national elections, the coup regime pushed through the demands of the Washington-based IMF. On past editions of this show, we've heard about international trade agreements written in secret by the Exxons and BPs and Monsantos and Cargills of the world and how these agreements are shoved down the throats of American human citizens by corporate persons with constitutional rights. Of course, we don't have the right to even know what's in these trade agreements, and leakers who do occasionally manage to show us parts of these agreements are threatened with assassination by right-wing politicians and persecuted by the Justice Department. As I said, we've heard that on this show. We've also heard that on Democracy Now! And the Heartland Labor Forum and other alternative media. But not so much in the mainstream media. And get a load of this. Yesterday, the corporate patsy Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court let loose the corrupt SCOTUS majority's opinion in the McCutcheon versus Federal Election Commission case. Here's what the New Yorker magazine's Borowitz report had to say about that. By a 5-4 decision, the United States Supreme Court today defended the right of the wealthiest Americans to own the United States government. Writing for the majority, Chief Justice John Roberts summarized the rationale behind the court's decision. In recent years, this court has done its level best to remove any barriers preventing the wealthiest in our nation from owning our government outright. And while the few barriers that remained were flimsy at best, it was high time that they were shredded as well. Citing the United States Constitution, Justice Roberts wrote, "Our founding fathers created the most magnificent democracy in human history. Now, thanks to this decision, the dream of owning that democracy is a reality." Justice Scalia also weighed in, telling reporters at the court, "After all the pro-gay decisions we've been making around here lately, it was nice to finally have a win for the good guys." I don't know about you, but I find it's a real challenge to live in a world and a country where it is really difficult sometimes to distinguish between Borowitz-style satire and a strange reality where Chief Justice Roberts can write, quote, "The line between quid pro quo corruption and general influence must be respected in order to protect basic First Amendment rights," close quote, of billionaires who want to express their speech in the form of millions of dollar bills. "The floodgates are open for political spending. Corporations write the legislation and by the legislators and the regulators, and they all meet on a regular basis as they go back and forth, to and from the revolving doors in the thin walls between government and corporate offices." And will the mainstream media, owned now by the 4 or 5 or 6 giant media corporations, inform us about the 4 or 5 or 6 giant agribusiness corporations who monopolize more and more of the earth and the seeds and farms, or about the 4 or 5 or 6 giant oil corporations who hasten global warming, or about anything else at all worth knowing? Journalism, as we used to know it, and desperately now needed, is dead. Circling back now to Vandana Shiva and her fight against Monsanto, I wouldn't be surprised if a considerable number of those listening this morning were among the 600 or 700 who turned out for a March Against Monsanto event on the Country Club Plaza in Kansas City last year. Lots of folks, lots of signs, a few speeches, a couple of minutes on a couple of local TV news shows. But great stuff, and I sincerely do support it. But think about it, and think about the current dismal state of journalism and media, and think about the concentration of corporate power now fully endowed with the constitutional rights of persons if none of the obligations of human citizens. Think about the warm, fuzzy TV commercials about family farms with the quiet tag of Monsanto tucked in at the end. Or the lies about feeding the world and the soft or friendly or totally lacking coverage of the real Monsanto by the so-called Real News, sponsored by guess who? Think about the Monsanto-friendly legislation passed by legislators lobbied by Monsanto lobbyists and looking towards the next election funded by Monsanto and other corporate election campaign donors. Yes, by all means, march against Monsanto as part of a struggle against their abuses. But if that's all you do, quit wasting your time. If you're not working to level the field in the media and to overturn corporate personhood and related issues, that is what you're doing, wasting your time and your friends' time, and you're not really serious about fixing anything. You've already lost. Think about that. And do come to the All Souls Forum this Sunday, co-sponsored by a media reform group that could really use a shot in the arm from you and your friends, and by the Kansas City chapter of the national group that wants to amend the Constitution to overturn corporate personhood and the idea that money equals speech. Come listen to Robert McChesney lay out some of the daunting problems facing us. And think about the most hopeful, rational, effective ways to solve them.
We'll hear argument first this morning in case 12536, McCutcheon versus the Federal Election Commission. Ms. Murphy?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, BICRA's aggregate contribution limits are an impermissible attempt to equalize the relative ability of individuals to participate in the political process. By prohibiting contributions that are within the modest base limits Congress has already imposed to combat the reality or appearance of corruption, these limits simply seek to prevent individuals from engaging in too much First Amendment activity. These limits cannot be justified on circumvention grounds because the concerns the government hypothesizes are already addressed by BICRA's multitude of more direct anti-circumvention measures.
How is that?
Because BICRA imposes numerous direct circumvention measures. For instance, we have earmarking provisions on earmarking contributions for a particular candidate. We have coordination restrictions on coordinated expenditures with the candidate. There are proliferation restrictions on creating multiple PACs that are all designed.
Yeah, all these were there at the time of Buckley versus Filio. And I guess the court thought something could happen like the following. Candidate Smith, you can only give him $2,600. But he has a lot of supporters. And each of them, 40 of them, gets a brainstorm. And each of the 40 puts on the internet a little sign that says, Sam Smith PAC, this money goes to people like Sam Smith. Great people. Now, we can give each of those 40 $5,000. They aren't coordinated. They're not established by a single person. Each is independently run. And we know pretty well that total of 5,000 times 40 will go to Sam Smith. Okay? What does that violate?
Well, there's a couple of problems with that hypothetical, Your Honor. First of all, there are base limits both on what can be given to a PAC.
$5,000.
And on what a PAC can give to a candidate.
$5,000. So all we have is my $5,000 going to the PAC, and there happen to be 400 PACs. So 5,000 times, 4,000. 5 times 40, 5 times 400, how much is that? I'm too good at math.
Without doing the math, I will tell you that earmarking and proliferation...
No, there's no earmarking.
But there's...
Because earmarking requires that you write on a check or in an accompanying letter that you want the money to go to somebody.
But actually, it does not. Earmarking, the FEC's earmarking regulations are broader than that. If you have a PAC that is going to contribute only to one candidate, you're not...
No, they'll contribute to several because they'll get more than one contribution.
At that point, then you don't have the kind of traceability you're talking about because there's more money coming into the PAC than can find its way to any one particular candidate.
I would think if you name the PAC after a particular candidate, as the hypothetical assumes, I would be surprised if the Federal Election Commission wouldn't come after you for earmarking.
That's exactly
well,
the
let's
point.
Say really? This one, Ms. Murphy. Let's say this one. You have 100 PACs, and each of them say that they're going to support the five candidates in the most contested Senate races. There are really only five very contested Senate races, and 100 PACs say that they're going to support those five candidates. So a donor gives $5,000 to each.
Well, that's it. We're out of time. You've been listening to the podcast edition of Tell Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us. Comments or questions, send an email to mail@tellsomebody.us. You can also follow me on Twitter @TellSomebodyNow. The Tell Somebody podcast is produced and distributed by Tell Somebody and may or may not reflect the broadcast of Tell Somebody heard on 90.1 FM KKFI in Kansas City, streaming around the world at www.kkfi.org. I'll be on 90.1 FM KKFI every Thursday morning at 9, right after Democracy Now! If you haven't heard Tell Somebody before, I hope you'll listen again. Check out the podcast and the broadcast. Click on a tile at www.tellsomebody.us for a link to a past show. If you enjoyed the show and appreciated the information you got from it, please tell somebody about the podcast and the broadcast. Spread the word to your friends and contacts by word of mouth or Facebook or Twitter or email list or any other way you can think of. This is Tom Clammer. I'll see you next Thursday at 9 a.m. on Tell Somebody or anytime you like at www.tellsomebody.us.